This is Erin Blanding, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Charmaine Royal and Dr. Lee Baker for People Science, and we're going to be talking about their research and these interesting times we're living in. So thanks so much for joining me today, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank
it's
you
a pleasure to be here.
Yes.
Awesome. So I'm wondering, just to get started, if you guys could tell me about your research and your field and what impact you hope your work has on your field.
All right, I'll start. So I am trained in human genetics and bioethics, and my research, my work, my scholarship, my teaching bring all of those things together. So I focus on ethical, legal, social implications of genetics and genomics, with a particular bent toward issues at the intersection of race and genetics. So what genetics tells us about race or not, and how we utilize concepts of race in our research, in our clinical practice, and in society. The ethical issues related to that, issues of justice, issues of benefit, all of those come into play in looking at issues of race and genetics. And in terms of what I hope my work brings to my field, and when I talk about my field, I could talk about genetics by itself. I could talk about bioethics by itself, because those two fields, what I hope my work brings to those are different, but also the intersection of those and looking at the ethical and social implications of genetics. So there are three fields that I pretty much talk about. So in terms of genetics, my hope is that my work focusing on ethical issues in genetics and social issues, and primarily looking at issues at the intersection of race and genetics, is that genetics, genetics has had a complex history with notions of race, in that genetics has, in many ways, perpetuated this notion of a racial hierarchy and innate biological difference. But genetics has also debunked those ideas in showing us that at genetic level, in terms of our DNA, we are more alike than we're different. There is more genetic variation within a population than between populations that we call races. So this idea of race and biological race, genetics as a science has told us that those ideas do not apply to humans. In the biological sense. So race is something we created and we made up, and Dr. Baker can surely speak more about that and the implications there for society. So I'm hoping that genetics, my work in genetics will allow geneticists as scientists and as professionals, clinical geneticists and genetic counselors, to think more deeply about our science and what it brings to our work as professionals and scientists, but also what it means for society, the role that genetics can play in dismantling these notions of racial hierarchies. I believe that genetics has a role to play and has a significant role to play in helping people understand what the science itself says and what it does not say. Bioethics has traditionally not dealt with issues of race and racism, because racism is really a lot of what we're talking about, and others. I mean, now with all that's going on, there are repeated calls for bioethics to take a stance against racism, and the field has been, and just like genetics, not very diverse in terms of ancestral diversity. But also bioethics is not, the field looks at a lot of issues in terms of healthcare and allocation of resources and autonomy and informed consent. But when it comes to justice and thinking about justice with regard to race and racism, the field has been literally silent. And over the years, many scholars, including myself, have been calling on the field to do more. And so I'm hoping that my work in genetics and bioethics will help inform both fields. And then thinking about the ethical issues in genetics, lots of issues all over the place beyond race and racism, and hoping that my work will also inform how geneticists and people using genetic information see genetics and look and examine the what it is that we can do and whether we ought to do everything we can do. Those questions are also important, and I'm hoping that my work will inform those questions.
Awesome. And what about you, Dr. Baker?
I wanted to say that, you know, Charmaine and I are both in the Department of African and African American Studies, and African American Studies is generally seen as an interdisciplinary field. But most of us who do interdisciplinary work in African American Studies might combine like literature and history, or in my case, history and anthropology, or visual studies and folklore or something like that. But Dr. Charmaine Royal uses interdisciplinary studies from the arts and visual studies to the sciences like genetics. And she brings the whole sweep of different disciplines to bear. She's one of the almost ambassadors for our department, because she reaches the biology students as well as the arts students, you know, the social scientists and the natural scientists, as well as all of the humanities. So I just want to give her a little shout out. And she didn't talk about her sickle cell work in the NCAA. She's been one of the leading ethicists in terms of thinking through the ethics of testing all athletes, whether they're a cross-country runner or superstar one and done freshman phenom, and what that those implications are. And she'll maybe talk a little bit more about that, but I want, for college students, I think that really resonates, because it impacts every single college athlete, whether you're at Mount Holyoke or Clemson. So it's an important project that I want her to talk about. So I am a I'm trained as an anthropologist. I study North America, you know, and in general, but my specialty in terms of research has been the history of anthropology, particularly the way anthropology as the science of race and culture has impacted the construction of race, just like genetics has played a role of both cementing ideological notions that race is sort of tangible, real, and sort of concrete. It also has done the work of demonstrating that race is fluid, it's nonsensical, it's a construct, but nevertheless a powerful construct that shapes people's opportunities. And I guess what, sort of at another level, what I want to, and I'm trying to show now, is that racism is such a scavenger adaptive ideology to ensure the maintenance of white supremacy and power in the United States and other places, that it does the work of then co-opting even science that tries to break down these notions. So it's almost like a, well, it's almost like a virus. I mean, I guess I'm just thinking that it's an interesting metaphor. I'm just thinking that right now. It's always adapting such that the racism and the anti-racism that was working in the 40s shifted to the 50s, shifted to the 60s, to the 70s, to 2000, 2020s, and we still are grappling with some of the same structures and caste systems of the 1890s, but just in new ways. And it's always an arc, let's say, of bending, sometimes very slowly, to justice, but nevertheless, every time we bend a little bit more, racism's there to pull it back. And you can consistently see this throughout the, pretty much the, you know, from the founding of, and the writing of the Declaration of Independence and the beginning of the Constitution, that race has continued to dog democracy. And most importantly, it is perhaps one of the most virulent ideology that has prevented us from forming a more perfect union.
Wow. It's really exciting hearing you guys talk about your work because it's really relevant and really cool.
Yeah, and you know, I would just jump in there, Erin. I mean, Dr. Baker talked about me, but and my work and our positions as colleagues in the Department of African and African American Studies. We, as you can see, there's an overlap in our work, and we teach in each other's classes. And for me, that's one of the rewarding aspects of being in AAAS, but also working with Dr. Baker, because there's so much overlap in our work, but there are distinct differences in terms of how they come together. So it's always a joy to teach students together. I teach in his course, he teaches in mine.
And then often our students will then take each other's courses.
That's right. That is true.
So it's fun because those students come into my course with a lot of knowledge, particularly on the biology side and stuff, and they kind of really help push it on. And then conversely, it's just like
that's
there's
right.
a group of
and
students
all about
that come.
Social constructions and the anthropology of race. Yes, absolutely. So they get a well-rounded education by doing our two classes.
Absolutely.
That's really cool. It's cool to hear about the collaboration because I feel like a lot of times everything seems so separate when they should really be tied together. So that's really awesome. And I'm wondering, other than a bunch of meetings online, I guess, what impact have the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement had on your research?
Well, on my research itself, both the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter beyond the Black Lives Matter movement, I'd say this rising up of racial injustice and the responses to it. I mean, as we all know, it's not new. It's just rearing its head all in all kinds of ways again in the last few months. But reinforced for me, the need to keep doing what I'm doing and to do it in even more rigorous ways to be able to influence the conversation, but also to bring about change and lasting change, lasting and transformation of our systems, of our thinking, and of people's lives so that we can save our lives. So it's given me even more motivation for the work that I do, both in bioethics and genetics and the intersection of them, and as well as my, for sure, the work on race and racism. But it's affected my research to, Dr. Baker talked about the NCAA study. That study was supposed to have started in June. And we're surveying athletes and trainers and coaches, athletic trainers, coaches, team physicians. One part of the study is to survey 13,000 athletes, student athletes, coaches, trainers across the country to ask about this, their experiences with the sickle cell trait screening that the NCAA is doing and started in 2010. And we were supposed to start recruiting in June. Of course, athletic programs are out. And we thought, okay, we're gonna be able to start hopefully in the fall, and many programs are canceled for the fall. So my team and I, we've been meeting almost weekly trying to figure out and talking with the NCAA, talking with one of our collaborators is an athletic trainer. She's a professor at UNC. It's a collaboration between Duke and UNC. and one of our colleagues at UNC is an athletic trainer, and great to have her on the team because she's connected and just finding out what's going on with college sports across the country is just been interesting. But it has had a direct impact on our study in terms of thinking about recruitment. We're kind of revising our recruitment plan. We're adding some questions about COVID to our survey, which we're almost wrapped up the surveys, but now we're coming up with some questions related to COVID because athletes have been out. And so it's impacted that study in a variety of ways. I wouldn't say it's all negative, but I think it's giving us different ways of thinking about this work, which we're still hoping to start, hopefully start piloting our surveys by the end of this month and then start surveying in September. We'll see how that goes.
I think for me, it has given me a broader understanding that what we teach is more important now than sort of ever. And the history and the contextualization of the movement for Black Lives, police brutality, and the disparity kind of writ large that COVID has exposed about, racial and economic disparities in America, I think it's so important to contextualize that in history. I mean, the tragedies of George Floyd and all of the victims of police brutality, it is within a trajectory of state-sponsored violence, and that people, it's almost breaks my heart that people are like, we gotta forget, we can't forget. Unfortunately, people said that about Ferguson. They said that about Rodney King. They said that about going all the way back. And one of the most brutal murders was Mary Turner of 1918. I mean, her husband was lynched. Her husband was lynched because he got caught up in a mass mob violence because one sharecropper shot his boss. So fair enough, the guy shot his boss, but the guy, and he was unfair, but the entire community went around lynching all the Black men. And Mary Turner said, this is wrong. We are America. This cannot stand. She was pregnant 8 months. They tied her upside down, hung her, took a knife, ripped the baby out of her belly, stomped on the baby, and shot her full of bullets. People don't even know who Mary Turner is. People are going to forget. I mean, there has been tragic, unspeakable violence in the United States. And it's part of the makeup. It's part of our culture, unfortunately. And I think we've just got to understand that, you know, race is real. Racism is real. And it is dogging democracy. And I hope we're at an inflection point. I pray that we're at an inflection point. But And I'm optimistic, but skeptical. And I think we have to sort of understand our history. I mean, it sounds corny, but we have to understand our history in order to sort of move forward and not go for the okey-doke. One of the things that I've sort of been listening and taking from this pandemic is sort of the power of narrative. And narratives are important, but they generate affect and they motivate people to change. But increasingly, whether it's President Trump or the mothers, or people are not looking towards data as a grounding point of the narrative. They're just sort of looking at narrative to generate affect to then generate an effective change. But I think we have to be very crystal clear, and I think it's important for our students to understand narrative is powerful and it can motivate people, but it's got to be backed up by science. It's got to be backed up by data. But then Charmaine and I get in this position because we have historically said, well, you can't trust science. So then where are you? And so it's a little bit tricky, but you know, our students are smart. Our students are going to, you will, Aaron, be a global leader in a complex world, but you have to sit with this stuff for a minute and try to understand how it impacts your everyday life and put it in a larger historical context. I think one of the other things that I think both Charmaine and I are proud about, and it becomes a unique experience, in this moment where you have polarized politics and everyone can consume information and news that just reinforces their own ideology without question, having 14 weeks sitting with peers and talking and reading about this and not just consuming news that just reinforces their own ideology and really questioning people and providing a safe space for people to sort of take risks with assumptions and discuss this is a real gift. And I don't even think students realize how powerful that is, that it's not just a quick podcast or a read or something, but it's a 14-week discussion about these issues with other people that may have different ideas, but you talking to that and thinking through that and reading this material and watching these films and hearing guest lectures, that's a real unique learning experience. That you, I think you need now more than ever, opposed to just watching even like one documentary.
That's right. That's right. I appreciate that, Lee, because one of the, you talked about trusting science. And one of the things that we do in our classes is to help students critique science, critique the literature, and not just take, I mean, I assign papers that, you know, are way out in terms of how people are thinking about race, and then those that are in line with the way I think and others. And so they get a spectrum of papers to read, and to be able to critique a science and critique articles that have been published, and not assume that because it's in a journal and somebody with a PhD published it, then, oh, it's gotta be right and it's gotta be good. And so it's always rewarding for me to hear students critique and give their perspectives on things that are in print and on things that researchers are saying. And that comes with teaching and this kind of interaction that Dr. Baker is talking about.
But it's a fine line, right? Because you want to be critical of science, critical of narratives, interrogate data. But then you also don't want to say, well, hell, anything goes. You can just make anything up. I mean, and like we see with some of our leaders, just pull stuff out of thin air because it generates a good story.
Right.
And that's it's a tricky balance, but I think it's important to grapple with.
I think that's especially interesting right now with all this conflicting information flying around about the virus. So it's interesting talking about critiquing it because you kind of have to. And so I'm noticing that I am really kind of what you said, Dr. Baker, optimistic but skeptical about the uprising happening today. And so I'm wondering what excites you guys most about what's happening today.
Well, what excites me most, you know, I've got a 21-year-old daughter, so she's in the same kind of cohort with many of the protesters, and she's been writing and protesting and doing her thing. What excites me but also totally depresses me is, you know, this was my generation, and I thought coming up through the 80s, you know, going up against apartheid, really taking advantage of multiculturalism, that we would hand off to our daughters and sons a better society. You know, I think the baby boomers, you know, the greatest generation, whatever, they did a great job. And then I kind of feel like, wow, these X generation folks kind of dropped the ball. Not really, but kind of. And so it's good to see the next generation excited, motivated, multicultural. I think that's a really important sort of interracial movement. And so the energy and the commitment is motivating and encouraging. I just literally kind of feel like, gosh, we did not leave it necessarily better off than when we inherited the country and became young leaders like back in the 80s and 90s.
I second that. If there's anything that excites me, it's the young people, your generation, Erin, and others to come, and their assertiveness and their determination. And I mean, a number of students have called me, students I've taught in the past, and called just to talk about what they're doing, what they can do, what they want to do in this space. And students who have taken the course, Race, Genomics, and Society, a couple of them have called it, Dr. Ryan, all the students that do need to take this course. You know, they need to understand about race and that just the desire for people to have more knowledge, as Dr. Baker was saying, to understand our history and understand where all of this is coming from. It's not new. And because it's not new, we need to learn from the past, learn what to do and what not to do as we think about transformation and sustained change and what's going to be different this time. So I am motivated and encouraged by the enthusiasm of college students, high school students. I mean, I have students who are calling and like, I'm going to a protest tomorrow. I'm like, make sure you wear your mask. You know, it's like, but just wanting to be out there and doing something. And my hope is that it will last, and it won't just be for this moment. As Dr. Baker is saying, it's, you know, we've been here before. We just lost John Lewis, and he did this in his time, and see where we are, pulling back on some of the very policies that he initiated and brought into place. And so the work, we have to come up with different ways of doing what we're doing so that the change can be sustained.
I felt very heartened that I got a note from one of my students that said, she's in a biracial relationship, and she said her boyfriend's parents were wanting to know a little bit more about race and all this sort of stuff. So she trotted out my syllabus and said, why don't you read this, this, and this? And she was like, it was so helpful that I just had, and, you know, I just gave them the links. And
yeah.
Awesome. Well, you know, kind of thinking about change less as a moment and more of a sustained structural thing, what do you guys think is the first step in making your field more welcoming to people of color?
I actually think we could do a better job demonstrating that majoring in AAAS is a benefit. I mean, I think, you know, both anthropology and African and African American studies, I often call the O majors, because you say you're majoring in AAAS and people go, oh, like they don't even know what to do with it. And there are, you know, very specific pathways and ladders, and people can get jobs, but students can't or won't take the risk. I mean, all of our AAAS majors are kind of entrepreneurial. You know, they're kind of like, yeah, I'm going to use this and do this, this, and this. And if that doesn't work out, I'm going to do that. And if that doesn't work out, I'm going to bet on this. And there's this sort of risk taking that shouldn't necessarily happen. Even in anthropology, people don't know what to do with it. So students have to be kind of both either, I have to say, it's a privilege to be able to do that. They have to be very confident that they'll make it on their way, or like kind of super privileged that whatever I major in, it's going to work out because I've got connections, or I'm going to do that. I don't know. It's just kind of a privileged position to be in. So I think, we can do a little bit better job with that. And I think advising and a whole bunch of other folks can say that taking majors that don't have an immediate payoff is going to be beneficial, you know, down the road. And we actually do have evidence to this, but it's not like 5 years out, it's like 15 years out, where people that are majoring in the natural sciences or public policy, you know, do well in the first 10 years, but those folks in the humanities in general and things like AAAS or philosophy end up over their careers doing really well because they already are kind of like risk takers. They can write well, they can think critically, they can sort of learn to learn very quickly and enter new fields and go up the ladder. So that's all this probably a long way to say we're welcoming, but we can do a better job sort of marketing that this is a beneficial way to spend 4 years learning a particular field.
Yeah, and I think that's great in terms of AAAS. And I think one of the things too, and you asked Erin about students of color being attracted to the field. But one thing Dr. Baker didn't mention is that we don't only have students of color in AAAS, right?
Right.
I mean, we have students from all backgrounds doing AAAS. And for students to recognize that it's not just a Black student department, right? Or faculty. We have faculty who don't identify as Black either. So recognizing that there is diversity in the department in terms of the faculty and ancestral, racial, quote unquote, diversity, but also in our students who take the course, and it's attractive to students of all stripes. I would also talk about your question about how our fields can become more attractive to students of color. And I think about genetics and bioethics as fields, not very diverse when we think about ancestry, at least in the US, I mean, depending on where you are. But my feeling is that those fields need to demonstrate more commitment to the issues that students, what I tend to call racially subordinated groups, might be interested in. It's genetics, bioethics, both of those fields are typically seen as white, lily white fields, and they are in many ways. And there are many of us who are not, but many students don't see us in the media reports and all the things where, you know, many of the productions that talk about genetics. And so there's not, for many students, not seeing people that represent their group tends probably, I'm not sure it does, but it could tend to perpetuate this lack of diversity. And the feeling that these fields are not welcoming and not open to a diverse group of people, when that is not the case. I wouldn't say they're not open. I just think they need to demonstrate that in more effective ways. And when people are in the field, to make sure that those people are treated respectfully and highlighted. I mean, genetics is a field, you know, it's a basic science field, but it's also a clinical field, a professional field. And so how students and trainees are treated in labs and it just goes on and on in terms of where racism plays out. And so the experiences of students that students have or may think they might have, I think needs to be addressed by these fields in how we address the issues that are most concern to students who have been traditionally and historically marginalized.
And Charmaine, you do a lot of mentoring, both of postdocs mm-hmm. and graduate students, both at Duke and probably around the United States, maybe around the world. Do you want to talk a little bit about the role mentoring plays in welcoming people of color to these fields?
Absolutely. You know, actually, right after this, I have another Zoom call with a junior faculty member. So I'm a mentor to the American Society of Human Genetics has a program for mentoring junior faculty of color. And I mentor at least one faculty member. And, you know, chatting with them about my experience as a geneticist, and I must say that I have been blessed in that I've had a really just a positive experience in the field, and having fabulous mentors, Black, white, and other, who have helped make me who I am in terms of my career. And my goal is to be that and more to the faculty and students I mentor, but helping them deal with situations at their institutions that may not have been as positive as the experiences I have had, and connecting them with people that I know in the field. I know a lot of people At NIH, I did my postdoc in genetics and ethical issues in genetics at NIH. And that, I can't say enough about that experience and what it did in terms of connecting me to leaders in the field who I'm still connected to. And so I lend my network to the students and the junior faculty that I mentor and help connect to them as well. And so having people who are in your corner makes a really big difference in terms of how you experience the field. And I also mentor people outside of the US, but and there too, in places where genetics in particular is not, you know, the resources are not as available as they are here, and helping them too to take advantage of things that I am able to do here. So it really, it is a rewarding experience, and also a necessary one for students of color in these fields, both bioethics and genetics, two fields that are known for not addressing issues of racism very well, but also not being very diverse in terms of race. So it provides a rewarding role. And my hope is that those that I mentor will also become mentors. And so we'll grow the field with students and faculty that are well mentored, but also become really good mentors.
So this has been Erin Blanding speaking with Dr. Charmaine Royal and Dr. Lee Baker about research and these interesting times we're living in for People Science. And thanks for tuning in.